Why, Mr. Anderson? Why? Why?
Why do you do it? Why? Why get up? Why keep fighting?
You believe you're fighting for something, for more than your survival? Can you tell me what it is? Do you even know? Is it freedom or truth? Perhaps peace? Could it be for love? Why, Mr. Anderson? Why? Why do you persist?
Everybody, this is Brett. Welcome back to the show. Today is September 15th. I'm in New Hampshire. Man, are things affordable here. As you know, I have been traveling through Massachusetts and spending most of my time in Connecticut. It can get a little pricey down there. So, you know, freestateproject.org. Anyway, today on the show, we are continuing with our series, Presence and Productivity. This is part four, where we're going to talk about the value of identifying and understanding next actions, projects, and procrastination. Here's where I'd like to start today. One of the most appealing aspects of the Getting Things Done system is that it's really just asking us to employ a lot of skills that we already have, that we're already using. And for me, I had just never done it in a defined, systematic way. But being able to give labels, give definitions to these types of skills and actions, for me, has been incredibly helpful. An example of this is something that we're going to talk about today, a process that our mind goes through very naturally. We've had so much practice doing this, but we're going to turn it into an explicit step-by-step method called natural planning. Just to review some of the things we talked about in the last show, five stages of getting control of your life: collection, processing, organizing, reviewing, and doing. And we talked about just briefly, like, well, you know, how are we choosing what we're going to do? So in each moment when we have free time or when we're trying to work through our projects, etc., and I don't even like to say work through our projects, right? Because that's not how we should talk, from what I've learned anyway. I used to say this all the time. I used to say, oh, I got a project to do. Well, that's not very empowering. Projects are big. They could have like 50 steps. They could require other people. They could require other materials, time I don't have, energy I don't have. Dang, I'm overwhelmed by this project. So we come through this method to think in terms of next actions. And the criteria that was provided for choosing next actions was fourfold. The first one is context. Am I in the right place? Do I have the right materials? Do I have the right people if I need other people to do this next specific thing? Do I have the time available? Do I have the energy available? And, you know, what's the priority level of this thing? Now, the beauty of the appropriate amount of front-end planning is that you do not need to see, if a project has like 60 individual steps, you do not need to see them all, you know? And what I would recommend, and this is what's worked for me so far, to avoid getting overwhelmed with something, is maybe you need to see the next four things. Maybe you need to see the next 10 things. Right? If they're maybe, say, 5 to 10 to 15 minutes each as far as time commitment to execute those steps. But you don't need to see everything, and this is where the natural planning model comes in. Because if there are some things that are clarified up front, it is not imperative to see every single step in the project from beginning to end right when you're first starting the project. Because if you make this natural planning model explicit, you know, and maybe this starts on the list, you know, here are the aspects of planning this project, and you can see the big picture, then you can trust moving forward without having every little specific in place. Because the truth is, you're really just setting yourself up for disappointment, aren't you? I've certainly done this to myself. What if there's somebody else involved that I need to rely on to do something and they're not available at the time that I need them? What if there's materials that I can't obtain or can't afford? Right? So to say this has to work exactly like this from beginning to end, yeah, that's setting yourself up for failure. It's like using a calendar as an organization system. There are other variables that are going to come into play that are ultimately probably going to upset that level of planning to that finite a detail. But this, I mean, the point where we're getting ready to actually do is after all of the stages of, you know, collection, processing, organization, and review have been done. So when we can see everything, right? And that's the horizontal of our lives, the horizontal control of our lives. Today, we're going to be jumping more into the vertical control, right? The depth of understanding within each thing we have to do. So I want to start by talking today about the five phases of planning a project. So Alan calls this the natural planning model, something that can be done in minutes, and we all know how to do it because we do it all the time. And here it is defined in a way that makes it, I think, easier to recall and use productively. You can think about it as the who, what, where, why, and when of any situation or desired outcome or plan or project, etc. So I'll tell you what they are, and then we'll go through them in detail. Maybe I'll add some commentary based on my own experience. Number one, defining the purpose and the principles, duh. Number two, outcome visioning, duh. Three, brainstorming, duh. Four, organizing, duh. And five, identifying next actions. Okay. In organizations, and maybe you've had this experience, people often try to go through this unnatural planning model, or even what is described as a reactive planning model. We need some good ideas right now. Well, good ideas never seem to appear that way, at least not from my personal experience or the experience that I've had working in organizations. Really, just like I remember working in marketing, and when that demand was made, it just kind of created a lot of awkwardness. So the natural planning model is certainly the easiest, and unfortunately, in today's organizational structures, it's often overlooked. So we start with the why, right? The purpose. Why do we want to do this? How does this contribute to something larger? I mean, let me personalize it, and we'll talk about the work that I've done on the podcast, and we're only doing that because it's the thing with which you are most familiar. If you're listening to this, I'll assume. I often kind of overlook that important question of how does this fit into the larger picture? Not always, but a lot of the time I do. What that means is that success doesn't get defined in a clear and obtainable way. There's no decision-making criteria. If there's no clear purpose, it's easy to be pulled in different directions by these creative impulses. And hold that thought, because we'll come back to that one. So the first phase of this is purpose and principles. That's purpose. Principles, what's the underlying guiding idea? For me, that one has always been easy, right? Well, you know what the mission statement of School Sucks is? The philosophical container, a context into which all of our media fits, essentially. But here's what I've learned, and I think this is important. Because like I said, this is a natural process that our brains are going through, but we might not be devoting the necessary time, attention, and energy to certain aspects, certain steps within this process. So I don't feel like I go about my work in a purposeless way. What I realize is that I'm often substituting having general principles from which I work and a general purpose for my life as far as what I like to do and what gives me satisfaction. And what's being overlooked there is the specific purpose of certain pieces of media. Now, sometimes, things that I put out, very purpose-oriented, and I think a lot about this is what we're trying to communicate, this is the audience. I go through painstaking editing processes, cutting out things that I really like and I really want to keep, but they don't serve the purpose and they need to go. But I'm also working on a schedule and I'm working on deadlines. You know, there's a criteria for keeping a podcast in the LRN rotation. The audience has an expectation of every, you know, X amount of days, there will be a new episode of this show. So sometimes the purpose, hate to say it, is just like a podcast needs to be out. And you can probably tell the difference between shows that are really serving the larger purpose of the message and the methods that we're trying to push on School Sucks with shows that are just filler. And some are filler. And they still have to meet the criteria that I think they'd be enjoyable to listen to, but they are filler. And what I've learned is that clarifying a purpose for a certain project allows it to move forward in a much smoother way than some kind of live filler show. We're going to get a little bit more into that. So that's purpose and principles. The second one is vision and outcome. And I would say that this is where I have allocated most of my time when I start doing something. This is the what. And this has a lot to do with creating images in the mind. Now, this isn't the secret, okay? But creating these images in the mind, it could just be like let's say there's a video that turns out to be 10 minutes. It could be three moments that were 15 seconds each that I said, oh, that's really powerful, or I think that really says something. But then I just have blank space around that. And so I would ask myself the question, okay, how do we fill blank space? All right, well, what's the context or the background knowledge or the problem that can be presented that makes those 30 seconds that I find so compelling as a motivating factor even more powerful? Seeing something from beyond its completion is highly motivating, I think, right? When you're just kind of chugging along through something, and you don't have a clear vision of the finished product, well, it's not very inspiring. It's not very motivating. I start to feel like I'm just trudging through and not enjoying the process, right? The process of doing this stuff, which is one of the reasons why I wanted to get more into doing video production, is I really enjoy the process. You know, there's something new to learn every time. There's something new to try. It's very exciting. Right. And then it almost becomes like the finished product, what achieves the purpose and what pushes the principles is like an added bonus because the process has been enjoyable. But just a quick note on outcome focusing. I made this video a few months ago called Why Libertarianism is So Dangerous. Now, look, let's be clear. I know that I'm not being interviewed by James Lipton on Inside the Actor Studio. It's like, oh, tell us about the process for that. I get it. It was an achievement for me, right? When I was done with that, I felt great. I said, wow, I'm getting better at video production, and I high-fived myself. So that's all. That's the extent of the success of that video, right? So I'm not going to go into all the details, but it was an achievement for me to finish that. But at one point during it, I was like, I don't want to do this anymore. It felt like I was trudging through it because it wasn't that I didn't have a clear outcome. I was losing enthusiasm because the whole video, that whole presentation that came from a podcast that I did years and years ago, the whole narrative of the video is really just an extended stacking the deck logical fallacy, if you think about it. For some reason, that was kind of sapping my motivation to finish it. But I thought it would also be a very entertaining video. But I didn't have that push forward momentum that I needed at the time. So what I did was I chose the music. This is a stupid story, but this is what I did. I chose the music that I wanted to use, that I wanted the video to end on. And I took a pre-made video clip I had. And it's just this simple graphic that says schoolsucksproject.com fading in and flashing out. That's how the videos end. And I set it up in Sony Vegas with the schoolsucksproject.com appearing at just the right moment in the music. So it was just like a 15-second clip of the last thing that you would see in the video, the song hitting the point that I want, and then schoolsucksproject.com coming up, which is always a nice kind of, you know, dramatic way to end. And I rendered it. And I watched it like 10 times. As if to say, after people see the product of my work, they will be at this moment right here. Then, whenever I got stuck, you know, trying to land or make some kind of effect work, or, you know, looking for a piece of footage or the next thing to say, and I was just like, oh, shit, back to Facebook. I would open that video and I would watch it. That 15-second, this is the end video. It's something about seeing that outcome led to me pushing through and finishing it. And all I'm saying, the only point, is this was something that was important to me, if not important to anybody else in the world. And, you know, I don't blame you if you feel that way. It was important to me. And that was one of the things that helped push me to completion, for lack of a better phrase, with that project. From there, we go on to brainstorming. Brainstorming is always fun. And when I started doing the podcast, I used to really like to do mind maps. I would do them on paper, and it would allow you to see everything in and create everything that was important as far as getting the ideas out of my head without having to judge them too much and say, oh, that's a stupid idea. And there were times where I would write things down, because we've talked about this a lot before. Don't try to do creativity or idea generation and organization at the same time. It's two different steps, where I would think of an idea and I would say, that's a really stupid idea. I'm going to write it down. Sometimes a lot of the stuff that didn't initially seem like stupid ideas wound up getting scrapped in favor of pursuing the stupid idea. And that was a lot more fun, and maybe even led to a more entertaining finished product. It's terribly important to get ideas out of your head and in front of your eyes. And this goes the other way too. I mean, there's a lot of times where I had like something swirling around in my head and would say, oh, this is brilliant. Oh, how terrific this is going to be. So I would externalize it. I would put it on paper and I would say, oh, oops, this is shit. This doesn't make any sense. There's no clear way to communicate this, but getting it out and then being able to see it is important. And it doesn't mean that there isn't a way to make that idea not shit. Just like I don't have it in the moment. And, you know, going back to the criteria for, is this something I should pursue right now? I don't have the time. I don't have the energy. I don't have the resources to turn this into something that I think is worth presenting to other people. So it will be tabled. And, you know, I'm happy to say that now I have a place where those things can be filed for later. So if there is some spark of an idea that says, oh, remember, that kind of relates to this thing that you thought of, but you said it was shit and you kind of tabled it. Well, now maybe I can go and easily find that thing, Evernote, and try to incorporate this new idea. Is that the missing piece? Is that what makes this work? When brainstorming is done, when everything is externalized and put in front of the eyes, well, then I say it's time to get organized. At least that's what I tell people, right? The little speech that I do in my SAT writing class has been, ooh, generate ideas first, then make sure you organize them. Well, in my own working process, I realized that the last two steps in the natural planning model, after I got all excited about doing something, I would just start trying to execute. And I wouldn't have things carefully laid out in a way that I could go forward most effectively and efficiently and ultimately with a minimal amount of stress involved in doing something like that. So the fourth and fifth steps in the natural planning model, organization, and then identifying next actions. So here we are at organization. We already talked about the why and the what. You know, this is the how, the who, the when, and the where. You identify all the significant pieces. You sort them. You identify components, sequences, priorities. At this point, you're ready to make an action list. Individual actions, right? So there's no more talk about doing a project, because you can't do that. And remember, one of the most important principles that's discussed in this whole program, or programs like it, as far as what's important to me, is getting things off your mind, freeing mental RAM, being productive in a less stressful way. So at every phase of working through a project, the question that I think needs to be addressed is, what needs to be done, considering what can be done here, to get this off my mind? so I'm not mentally swimming in this anymore. And at any time in a project, you might need to send your attention in one of two ways. We could, I think in the book, Alan describes this as sending the attention up or sending the attention down. If something feels directionless, well, that means the attention needs to go up. You need clarity. You need purpose. You need to look at the big picture. If things seem disorganized or out of sorts in any way, well, your attention needs to go down to the actions, the lower issues of the project, the specifics, the details. And that translates into the next actions. But first, I want us to pause. I want you to think about the unnatural planning model that you were forced to use for at least four, most likely six, if not even a few more years of your life. Very formative years, your schooling. I'm talking about middle school and high school here, if not extending beyond those two periods in both directions. Was there ever any discussion about purpose and principles or outcome focusing? Do these habits for many of us carry into adulthood? I think so. In fact, you might even know a couple of adults who consider their profession, their work, what they spend about 1/3 of their waking life doing to be completely purposeless. It's kind of sad, but it's reality for most people. And here's why purpose is important. I encourage you to go back and listen to the show I did with Jeremy Franzen from Internet Business Mastery. It's 206 or right around there. School is about extrinsic motivators. Get good grades, stay out of trouble, get into college. Intrinsic motivation has value beyond what we've even explicated on the show so far, when it comes to working efficiently and effectively and time management, and it is this. Have you ever heard of something called The Secret? Well, it's a bunch of New Age nonsense, frankly, but there's something there, okay? It's not magic. Here's what it is. Here's what I've noticed from my own experience. I might have mentioned on the show before that I used to have these two teacher's assistants. They were both miserable people. They were always complaining about something. And bad things kept happening to them. Now, I wouldn't describe this as the universe sending the messages and the events that they call out for. This has to do with perception. You know, this has to do with the mind as a projector on the screen that is reality. Tie this to what we've discussed about the mainstream media. People seek out the New York Times or Fox News because it makes them feel comfortable. The things they see in those places fit into a mode of thinking, a mindset with which they are already very comfortable. People who are always in a negative mindset will hyper-focus their attention on things that are shitty. Here's an example from my own life. I'm not proud of this. I go to Planet Fitness. I'm not proud of any part of this story. Oh my goodness, but here, I'm going to tell it. I go to Planet Fitness. Why? For one reason, because it has locations everywhere and I go a lot of different places. Planet Fitness has this business model where they said they would create a gym for people who were uncomfortable, made uneasy by all of the harsh realities of ordinary gyms. So they would make a place that's judgment-free. That's their slogan. Check your ego at the door. They have signs that say this. On Friday, calm down. On Friday, they have a pizza party. A pizza party. A food with absolutely no redeeming nutritional qualities, the smell of which fills the gym on Fridays. Everything in Planet Fitness is painted purple to let you know that it's a place where you can have fun. I would describe Planet Fitness. If anyone asked me, should I get a membership at Planet Fitness? I said, only if you need to travel. Only if you need to travel and you need to be able to maintain some kind of consistent gym schedule while you're on the road. They would say, tell me more about it. I would say, it's 20% gym, 70% children's television show, and 10% fucking pizza party. Is it clear without me maybe being more explicit what my general attitude is towards this facility? I've caught myself so many times walking in the door, checking in, and looking for something to be upset about. Road rage. The exact same kind of mindset. Who is going to F with me next out here in traffic? Looking for something to be angry about because we're already in that mindset. People who are always, or at least generally, in a positive mindset will try to find the positive because it's compatible with the mindset that they already have. When you have a purpose in a specific pursuit or a project, that frame of reference allows you to better focus in on the things that serve that purpose. So when you're in this purpose-based mindset, this is what we want to achieve and why we want to achieve it. All of the things, all of these inputs that can create such a mess in a person's psyche can be better filtered. That doesn't serve the purpose. This does serve the purpose. I'll take it in. I'll put it where it needs to go. Unfortunately, this planning model that is so natural is something that we don't get a lot of practice with during our schooling. So before we move on with today's show, let's just do a quick review. When taking on a project, natural planning works as follows. The first thing we do is we define our purpose and our principles. We ask why. The answer to this question brings all kinds of benefits. It shows us what success should look like. It helps us constrain decision-making. Does this serve the purpose and the principles, or does it not? It helps us get our resources in order. It motivates us. It clarifies the focus, and it can even expand the options because we're not wasting time on things anymore that don't serve the purpose or meet the principles. The principles themselves can create a certain kind of boundaries, right? The same reason I wouldn't have some quantum physicist or Giorgio Tsoukalos, the guy from Ancient Aliens, on the podcast, because they can't do anything for us. And that would be a waste of my time and yours and theirs. The second thing, outcome visioning. Being able to see some kind of picture of the finished result. In the book, Alan talks about the reticular activating system. Similar to purpose and principles, once the outcome is defined, once there's some kind of picture of it, the brain will start to search for things that align with that vision. The next thing we do is brainstorming. Externalize everything in the brainstorming process. Don't be afraid of stupid ideas. Every great innovation, I think, in history, at least in the last century, I mean, you can think of so many. When the person first said, hey, what if we do this? Somebody was there to say, that's a stupid idea. So brainstorming is most effective when ideas aren't being judged or challenged. They're just being externalized. This is where you want to get as many ideas as possible, not the best ideas possible, or seemingly the best ideas possible. When all that stuff is out, step four, let's organize. Let's see what we have and see how it fits together. Components, sequences, priorities, etc. Step five is what Tony and I are going to talk about on the show today. The importance and the power of the next actions principle, which can be summed up very simply as this. Next actions allow us to define what real doing looks like, which produces not only empowerment, but also motivation. Plenty of us know how to identify next actions, but we'll also discuss today why most of us might not be doing them. So we collect everything, we process it, we organize it, and then obviously the most important step in getting things done is the doing, even though, you know, the collection from the processing are very important as well. So you review everything once it's organized, and then you're ready to do.
Right. Let's bring it back a little bit.
Okay.
What I think most generally, and a lot of people can relate to this, is they have a sort of, and I like the terminology he used, a serenity through force. Mm-hmm. Like we have, you know, especially myself, and I'm sure everyone can relate to this, tend to procrastinate a little bit on projects that we haven't very well defined, right? And so that procrastination, you know, you get to a certain situation where you just feel so uncomfortable. You feel like there's so much that hasn't been done, or there's just something that's just nagging at the back of your brain a little bit. Mm-hmm. This little voice maybe back there just screaming at you. Not mm-hmm. quite sure why. Could be screaming about something totally different, but you know it's from something else.
Right.
And finally, you're forced into it almost like aggressively. And so we have all this emotional baggage we bring with it, and it feels like it's like the weight of the world is on our shoulders, and we can't deal with it. There's too much. Mm-hmm. Too much. It's the night before. Project's due tomorrow. As everyone's going through government schooling, I'm sure.
Right, right.
And, you know, what do we do? Well, we pull an all-nighter. And yeah. all of a sudden we get it done, but it's like the most painful, most arduous task we could possibly go through.
Yeah.
Because, first of all, there's no internal value that we really wanted to do it in the first place, and we didn't really recognize it, name it, and go through this simple step of essentially taking right actions that would alleviate that sort of stress and anxiety that comes with waiting to the last minute. And so I think most generally people can probably relate to some sort of aspect of just the procrastination. And why does that happen? Like, that's really the key questions. Like, why would you procrastinate on something?
Ooh, give me the book.
Give me the book.
I think this, I stumbled across this today when I was preparing for the show, and I thought this was really interesting. Why bright people procrastinate the most? It's really the smartest people who have the highest number of undecided things in their lives and on their lists. Why is that? Think of how our bodies respond to the images we hold in our minds. It appears that the nervous system can't tell the difference between a well-imagined thought and reality. To prove this to yourself, picture yourself walking into a supermarket, close your eyes, everyone, and do this, and going over to the brightly lit fruit and vegetable section.
Mm.
Are you there? Okay. Now go to the citrus bins, oranges, grapefruits, lemons. Now see the big pile of yellow lemons. There's a cutting board and a knife next to them. Take one of those big yellow lemons and cut it in half. Smell the citrus smell. It's really juicy, and there's lemon juice trickling onto the board. Now, take a half lemon and cut that in half. So you have a quarter lemon wedge in your hands. Put the quarter of the lemon in your mouth and bite into it. Scrunch.
This could be really taken out of context.
I was just going to say that. lemons. Because what he says here, if you played along with me, you probably noticed that the saliva content in your mouth increased a little bit. Your body was actually trying to process citric acid, and it was just in your mind. And by now, the people listening to the podcast know about this clutter article that we will have dealt with, where we talked about the Apple Store. We talked about it in last week's live show. They want you to go in there and touch things. Yep. They want you to have a tactile experience that translates into an emotional attachment to their stuff.
That's
even though you don't own it, they want you to feel the ownership. If your body responds to the pictures you give it, how are you likely to feel physically when you think about, say, doing your taxes? Are you sending yourself easy, let's go, completion, success, and I'm a winner pictures? Probably not. For just that reason, what kinds of people would logically be the most resistant to being reminded about a project like that? That is, who would procrastinate the most? Of course, it would be the most creative, sensitive, and intelligent people. Because their sensitivity gives them the capability of producing in their minds lurid nightmare scenarios about what might be involved in doing the project and all of the negative consequences that might occur if it weren't done perfectly. They just freak out and in an instant quit. Who doesn't procrastinate? Often it's the insensitive oafs who just take something and start plodding forward, unaware of all the things that could go wrong.
I do know people like that.
Everyone else tends to get hung up about all kinds of things. Now, okay, sure. So what we're talking about is people who just go forward.
Yes.
Now, you already have the tool set. If you're a procrastinator, here's what you should understand. You already have, which we all have, but you're already employing the tool set necessary to get more things done, even through your procrastinating, because what that means is that you have this processing space between input and output.
That's right.
Who doesn't have that? Soldiers.
giving and receiving and following out orders
right.
by someone else. So they have to essentially, you know, arrest that ability that we all have naturally.
Yeah.
Now, you know, we've talked about many times, especially in Tragedy and Hope, about like the trivium, of mm-hmm. course. And that's just my most immediate reference. But just in between stimulus and response, you know, there's that space for a question. It's true. Essentially, that's what they're trying to remove. You know, I've read a lot of philosophy, and I, you know, not to go too far on a tangent, but a lot of the most recent philosophy with symbolic logic and computer language, the only way their equations work to a human is if they remove that self-reflexive questioning process in us. That's sort of what we call consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they need to turn us into an, you know, an input output sort of response machine.
Right.
And that's just what is that? It's binary code.
Right.
And on, off, on, off, on, off. And that's essentially what it's the only way their equations will work.
Yeah.
Essentially to guide social systems and institutional constructions and how we engage with them. So
right.
It applies to all areas, ironically. And so what he's just pointing out is a method to be able to deal with that, essentially that emotional proclivity for frustration and for just immediately responding to something without really thinking. And that's the beauty about this tool. It ties directly in with all these other tools. You mentioned NVC earlier, and then, you know, I'm mentioning the Trivium now. So
right. Do my taxes? Oh no, it's not going to be that easy. It's going to be different this year, I'm sure. I saw the forms, they look different. There are probably new rules, and I'm going to have to figure them out. I might have to read all that damn material. Long form, short form, medium form, file together, file separate. We'll probably want to claim deductions, but if we do, we'll have to back them up, and that means we'll need all the receipts. Oh my God, I don't know if we really have all the receipts we'd need. And what if we didn't have all the receipts, but we claim the deductions anyway, and we get audited? Audited. Oh no, the IRS. Jail. And so a lot of people put themselves in jail just glancing at their 1040 forms because they're so smart, sensitive, and creative. In my many years of coaching individuals, this pattern has been borne out more times than I can count. Usually it's the brightest and most sophisticated folks who have the most stuck in piles in their offices, homes, and heads. Most of the executives I work with have at least several big, complex, amorphous projects stacked either on a credenza or a metal shelf. There always seem to be hobgoblin thoughts lurking inside them. If we don't look and think about our projects, maybe they'll stay quiet. So what's the solution? There's always having a drink. Numb it out, dumb it down. Notice what happens to many people when they get a little alcohol in the brain. It should drop their energy immediately because it's a depressant. Often, though, the energy lifts, at least initially. Why? Alcohol is depressing something. It's shutting down the negative self-talk and uncomfortable visions that are going through these folks' minds. Of course, my energy will increase if I stop depressing myself with overwhelming pictures of not handling something successfully. But the numb-out solutions are temporary at best. The stuff doesn't go away. And unfortunately, when we numb ourselves out, we can't do it selectively. The source of inspiration and enthusiasm and personal energy also seems to get numbed. So what he's talking about here, and it's the next heading in the book, is what he calls intelligent dumbing down. We were talking about this over our dinner tonight. We want to be big picture people, right? Yeah. We want to be able to see everything and understand how the puzzle all fits together. But it's
that's
like,
what the mind does first.
Right.
It processes. But it doesn't always make explicit that identification.
Yeah. And it wants connections, right?
It does.
Like with the brain model, you want to be able to look at the whole thing and say, I get it.
Yep. That's right. Everything's just immediately.
Cecil available. Rhodes. I get it. You know?
Round table groups.
Right. Right. But there's all of these parts that you have to understand individually. I mean, that's again, the trivium. That's the grammar of a bigger picture
exactly.
understanding of something. So this is like...
That's exactly right.
I have this GPS system in my car. It's called TelNav. And sometimes what it does, and it annoys the shit out of me, is it'll go from the step-by-step directions to just a map of the whole trip. Right. So if I'm driving 40 miles, it's showing me a map of a like a 60 mile radius.
And what do you have to do when you see the map? It's like, oh, well, I'm looking at that highway. I'm looking at this highway. And you're trying to make those relationships.
I'll be like, yep,
the whole map.
I'm in New England. Thanks, GPS. But I
need to figure that out.
What I need to know is what's the next step? What's the next thing I'm going
exactly.
to do? So this is the what he calls the intelligent dumbing down. What do I need to do next? Right. We can only do actions. We can't do a project because a project has many steps, many components, materials, other people involved, time-sensitive matters, non-time-sensitive matters. We can only do the individual actions, the next actions. So when we're talking about this intelligent dumbing down, what we started the show with, the importance of identification.
Yes.
What's next?
It's, you know, it correlates exactly with the trivia method and the general grammar stage. Mm-hmm. But, you know, essentially the input, processing, output, you first have to observe your environment. Oh, I have a bunch of papers, a bunch of emails. What do you do next? Well, then you have to, you have to collect it. Mm-hmm. And you have to start processing it. And just the way you do that, and this is it's not counterintuitive. It's just so simple. We don't think about it. It's naming it. That's why he talks about a label maker. That's why he talks about making like this one, using one term for something. You know, not too many words, not a phrase, just a simple one word, a label, whether it's in your mind or whether it's like something on a physical label you're making.
Right.
Just to be able to recognize it, categorize it, and put that stuff in one place. So then you know at least it's in one place and you can deal with it when you prioritize your time based on the importance of, let's say, a project list. But I think, you know, this, that one key step, what we were talking about before with what you read from the book, there's that sort of psychosomatic response. Like the mind is conjuring up all these images, and what do you feel? You feel anxiety, feel frustration, feel anger, because you have all these like disaster scenarios running in the head because you haven't really properly named what is, quite frankly, so simple, the next action.
Yeah.
You have not named the next action. Instead, you're naming you have this amorphous, nebulous blob of relationships without any names to it, without the name, without that first concept, how do you relate to anything else?
Right.
And so you have to start with that. It's a matter of focusing your energy because there's all that energy. The mind's making all these disastrous connections in the head. You feel frustrated, you feel angry. So there's a lot of energy flowing, right? The blood's pumping a little bit faster. Right. You got the adrenaline pumping. And so essentially it's just taking that energy and focusing it by naming the next actions that need to be done. So first you observe your environment and then you start to name it. You identify it through actually giving it a name. And then from there, your mind naturally does what it already does. It processes information. It mm-hmm. just puts it into a category. So I'll say, okay, I have a bunch of, I have a project maybe for health and I have all this information. And so what do? I name it health and I put all the information in there. And depending on how big it grows, I might categorize it a bit more, but at least I have it's all in one place now and I can, based on priorities, get to it based on, clearing out all the other clutter. Mm-hmm. But this is really one of the first steps. It's gaining that control, right? It's essentially getting your situation back under control, both mentally, and that relates to our actions physically and how we relate to it. So
it's like one of those scary kids cartoons when you don't do this identification, like where these things come alive and like, I am gum disease, that kind of thing. So all this just starts public dancing around you in singing in like this weird 40s Disney movie. Very creepy. Are shit that you don't know what to do with, that you don't understand.
Don't understand, but it's going to kill you.
And they just keep like dancing around you and nagging you. And this your life. There's all of these unidentified things that are surrounding you that are distracting from your ability to focus on what you do understand, right? Because you can feel all that stuff going on around
you. And then that feeling translates and then the way in which we engage with our actions. Mm-hmm. And that's what I mentioned earlier, that idea of serenity through force. Yeah. Finally, it becomes so frustrating. We're forced into it. And that reminds me of the sort of repetitive, habitual behaviors we develop. A lot of it's in the school system, parenting, and all these sorts of things. We've already kind of indoctrinated to a system where we feel like we need the force, whether the force is coming from an authority or whether it's coming from, some external abstract idea. Nonetheless, we're getting ourselves into a situation where we're being forced to do something rather than recognizing it and prioritizing it based on our needs.
Yeah.
Needs for survival or needs just for, a mental clarity, whatever our basic needs are. And that's the difference because it allows a lot more freedom and allows a lot more clarity and thought and creativity ultimately.
And that's the subtle message all through school where none of those things are fostered.
Right. That's exactly.
And the whole thing is for your own good. Force for your own good, right?
Yeah.
So the...
It's essentially using chaos to reinforce the need for order.
Right. So when you explain this feeling to people of like, I don't feel like I have a tremendous amount of self-efficacy. And they say, well, I never felt that way. I always felt that way. It's in there. That feeling's in there. It's been built into you through those 12 years of experience that you've had. Or it at least affects your thinking and ultimately your doing.
Yes.
For most people, it did for me. I mean, I can't speak for everybody. Maybe there are some people who started that at the impressionable age of five and everything just rolled right off their back. And they were like, well, these people are full of shit. You know, I ain't falling for this. I got to be productive when I get out there. But people can get pretty far in life, never even understanding or experiencing
actually, just how much stress
intrinsic motivation.
Right. That's exactly right.
So the other part of this, just to sum up this whole next action thing and the thought that goes into a project that more sensitive and thoughtful people, as David Allen says, seem to, you know, put into things, is that immediately you're less overwhelmed.
Yes.
Right? Because things have been identified and they've been organized and you can see what the next action is. But there's also here something else that I don't think we get from the typical way of doing things or the way things are done in school and in a lot of the professional world. And that is empowerment.
Self-esteem.
Most next steps are easy, you know?
Once you name it.
Once you name it and you understand what it is, and it's the next
all of a sudden,
thing.
The
right?
focus, that energy just goes to it and it becomes an automatic process. And what happens? You develop a habit because it feels good to complete a simple next step. All of a sudden, the project's done.
Yeah.
How the hell that happens? Because I wasn't focusing on the totality of the project. I was only focusing on that one next step that helped led to the finishing that project.
Right.
And that's really the trick. You know, David Allen, in his lecture series that I first, you know, heard and went through, he mentions that, and I already mentioned this earlier on, but the idea is like all these open loops, a lot of times we'll then be out with friends, we'll be in a heated discussion or communication, something will just trigger us to get really angry. But we already have that sort of predisposition to an emotional outburst, essentially because we already have all these open loops. So it really affects our psychology internally as well. And it relates actually, I mean, a lot of this research he's done to put together this method is based on like recent psychology research. So it's you know, we find this a lot in different people selling different methods for essentially the same thing. It's really kind of simply how the mind works, how it deals with stress, how it deals with information, and what can happen in the two polarities. And so he mentions, like, you know, a lot of times we end up becoming frustrated from something completely tangential, has nothing to do with like some of the things we were trying to focus on. Something will come in, punch us on the side, and next thing you know, we flip because we don't have that sort of mental clarity. Just like Rich used the analogy or the metaphor of those group of thugs, and like if they all attacked you at once, unless you're like an incredible martial artist, you're probably going to get taken down. But if you attack each one by one and have the mental clarity to analyze each one, observe each one, name each one, and deal with that one by one.
The importance of identification.
Yes.
What's next?
Yep, that's right.